Be no breakfast 2 weeks?
Breakfast will be catered. Will be catered, but we don't have to bring it.
Oh, you don't have to bring it.
So today is November 18th. It's our second session this morning, an introduction to Mishnah and Talmud. We're still in Masechet Brachot, Perakei, Mishnah Gimel. And we're going to do everything. So here we go. So, as far as the Mishnah itself, right, the questions, as far as the Mishnah itself, it sounds like everyone's really on track, so we'll just go over the questions rather quickly. I assume everything is clear. We could begin at the beginning of the Mishnah, even the questions I gave you in reverse order to help out a little bit, but now that you know it, we can begin from the beginning of the Mishnah, which means in the question sheet part B. So it says, who is the Omer that the Mishnah is referring to? And that's clearly the Shalich Tzibur, right? That everyone understands. It's at the beginning of the Mishnah HaOmer.
Yes.
It's not someone in private prayer. It's the Shalich Tzibur, the Chazan.
Yeah.
And that person can also be called Haver Lifnei Teva. That person who passes in front of the box. The box referring to, of course, the Aron HaKodesh. And the reader's stand is right in front of, is right near the Aron HaKodesh, which is in the front of the Beit HaKnesset. And of course, we also understand the answer to the question, too, that these are things in our Mishnah that should not be said, not things that should be said. That's also clear. Now, as far as the third question, what is the meaning of Mishakimoto? We could have brought up two possibilities. It could mean that we tell him to be quiet. In other words, don't say what you were saying, but say it properly. Or a different possibility would be we throw him out. We get rid of him.
We silence him, yeah.
The question is, again, do we silence him permanently or just for what he was saying? Do we get rid of him completely?
Just for what he's saying, yeah.
So the answer to that comes from the end of the Mishnah where we find the phrase, it says, Ya'avor acher tachtav. So the Mishnah knew the phrase, Ya'avor acher tachtav. If it doesn't use that phrase at the beginning of the Mishnah, it rather says, Mishakimoto. Apparently, Mishakimoto does not mean Ya'avor acher tachtav. It means the same person stays there, but just he should be told not to say what he had been saying. So apparently, even though these three things are heresy, they're not so bad that we throw the guy out of town. We don't even throw him out of the synagogue. We don't even put someone else in his place. We just remind him those are things we don't say in our place. Like it had said in the Parsha, we don't do so bimkomoteno. Right? Lavan said to Yaakov that we don't put the younger before the older in our place. We don't do such things around here.
Okay. Couldn't the modim, couldn't a couple of these just be, he doesn't necessarily know what it sounds like that he's saying. He may not be intending to, you know, make it sound like he's praying to two different powers or stuff like that. He just may be
making a mistake.
Making a nice prayer. He's saying modim twice just to make it sound really
song,
nice.
Just to stop singing the service.
Right. That's right. Not the way the commentators take it. And it could be, although I checked a lot of historical books, and no one knows exactly what type of heresies are going on here. Right. Some people say it might be Zoroastrian influence. Others say early Christian influence. Others say that perhaps the Essene, the Dead Sea Scroll sect, had some type of belief in two Rishuyot.
So these guys are doing it on purpose.
So I'm just saying, no one is exactly clear. We don't have historical evidence that people actually said these things except for this Mishnah.
Right.
But still, the Mefarshim seem to be assuming that they do represent some type of heretical deviancy.
He's not just saying it because it sounds better to say it twice. He's doing it because...
Apparently.
Or, I guess, regardless of what he's thinking, you know, it may be innocent on the Chazan's part, but still may be...
It's known to be...
Sounds like something.
Right. It could be interpreted as... You know,
yeah, because there is some type of historical movement. There's something going on there.
Davin Shachas, and he repeated everything twice.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of that.
I was over there, yeah, and listening to him. Nobody stopped him.
Or...
Yeah,
I thought you said somebody stopped him.
Huh?
Didn't you say somebody stopped him, or this is somebody
no,
else?
No, nobody stopped him.
Oh, really?
Okay. Even later on, after the Shemoneh, before the Shemoneh, before the lounging Shemoneh, the rabbi, the redhead rabbi, mm-hmm. What's his name?
Abba Meir.
Went over there and talked to him, had a talk to him, before he started the repeating the Shemoneh. And he told him something, and he stopped.
Kind of relevant.
Because he was repeating everything twice.
Really?
what do you call it? Birkat HaChodesh?
Repeating
and repeating.
All right, that was the Israeli Chazan.
Mr. Goodman.
It's too much
repeating.
So anyway, everyone probably noticed that this matter of Alkan Sipur, I'm now in question four. It comes from Sefer Bamidbar.
I don't even say that.
You don't get any inspiration, though. It's too...
you won't
right.
see it on the shul.
I agree. Let's go on. So question five says, what understanding of the reason of the mitzvah discussing these verses, in other words, Kan Sipur, is reflected by the statement, Al Kan Sipur Yagiu Rachamecha. It's also clear that somehow the person who says that is saying that the reason we send away the mother bird before we take the eggs or the chicks is because of Rachamim. That's clear. The word Rachamim is there in the words that he says. And then I asked what could be wrong or problematic with this statement. So let's think. This is a little hard to do because you've already seen later sources. But a priori, I can think of at least three ways to look at it, of what's wrong with saying that this mitzvah is a function of God's rachamim. Mm-hmm. What are the three? At least two of the three.
That God doesn't have mercy on the animals because he allows us to use them.
In other words, you're saying that factually, there is no mercy in this mitzvah.
Right.
That's a certain possibility. I'm going to call that possibility two.
For our benefit, that for man's benefit, the animals, and we can use them as long as we can benefit from them.
Okay. So I'm going to call that reason number two. And I'm going to look for one and three.
Well, so, I mean, this is it's not a priori, you know. But so the one thing that was suggested was that it... puts limitations or boundaries, I guess, by describing Hashem's mercy that's applicable under certain situations.
Yeah.
Which by implication could be that under others it's not necessarily.
Yeah.
If they're not stated.
Mm. So I'm going to call that three.
Okay.
And then what would be the remaining possibility that you saw in some of the literature? It's actually the first one in many sources.
Is it the time to the mitzvahs? It's giving a reason, or did we say that?
Yeah, already? And you shouldn't give a reason.
Right.
So in other words, and that's going to be what I'll call one. So the first possible way of looking at this matter of Alkan Sipur is that categorically you should not search for reasons for the mitzvot. You should not search for tamei mitzvot because you should relate to all the mitzvot as gzeirot, or what we call today as chukim. Mm-hmm. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu did them in order to put his authority upon us, Ol Malchut Shemayim, you have to do what you're told, obedience, submission, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu, don't start looking for reasons. It could be a very, very bad thing to look for reasons, as the Midrashim of Shlomo HaMelech say, that once he found the reasons, he put all his focus on the reasons and not on the physical mitzvah itself. And then you might find a case in which the reason doesn't apply, so I don't have to do the mitzvah. Or you think I can accomplish the reason through a different act. And the reason becomes central and the mitzvah itself becomes secondary. So that's one possible way of looking at it. I'm not saying it's the only way, but one possible way is that tamei mitzvot is an act to be frowned upon. It's a philosophical endeavor. It's a way of thinking. It's a religious worldview that's really to be distanced from us. We should accept the mitzvot as is with no questions asked and don't give tamim. And this person that gives a tam, he's involved in something that is theologically questionable. That's number one. Number two is what David said, is not to say there's a problem with tamei mitzvot. It's fine. But this particular tam is wrong. That's all. This particular tam is wrong. You can't say that the reason is rachamim, because, like you said, the Kodesh Baruch Hu lets us slaughter animals for our benefit. And the third way of looking at it is what Amiram said. Not that you shouldn't be involved in tamim, and not that this tam is wrong and this is not rachamim, but that this person doesn't attribute enough rachamim to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He sounds like he's saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is rachamim only.
Only one thing.
On the birds. But the truth is rachamim al kol ma'asav and all his creations. So the third way of looking at it, as well as the second, doesn't have any problem with giving Tamim, you're allowed to give Tamim, that's fine. Perhaps it's even a good thing to give Tamim, but the Tam was wrong or the Tam was too limited. And like I said in the introduction, it turns out this Mishnah is going to be a nexus. It's going to be really the ground for the 2,000-year discussion in Jewish sources of the question of Tamei HaMitzvot. Should you or should you not? Is a good thing or a bad thing? The first approach says it's a bad thing. The second two approaches say it might be a wonderful thing. The problem is not here in the giving of Tam. It's in that it was the wrong Tam or too little, too limited of a Tam. But Tamim itself is fine. Just find the right Tam. Okay. So that brings us to question 7, which is, in what blessing do you think that such a statement or prayer would be included? And we can already go to the Rambam and to Rashi. Notice that it's a machloket between Rashi and Rambam, apparently, where you would put Al Kan Sipur Yagiru Rachamecha into the tefillah if you did such a thing. So we go to, let's say, to the Rambam. And the Rambam says in his Pirush HaMishnah, which, as I mentioned earlier, was written in Arabic, and it's shunted here into Hebrew by Rav Yosef Kapach only about 40 years ago. And it's put out in 3 volumes of the Rambam, Pirusha Mishnah the Rambam, on the whole Shas. And he says, Inyan Amaro Al-Kan Sipur Yagiru Rachamecha, the matter of his saying, Al-Kan Sipur Yagiru Rachamecha, Hu Shiyomar, that is that he will say, Kishem Shachasta al Kan Sipur, just like you had pity on the Kan Sipur, on the bird's nest, Va'amarta, and you said, Lo tikachim al abanim, don't take the mother with the children, Kama, Kach Chusaleinu, so you should have pity upon us. Shomer came, when he says thus, Mishakimoto, we quiet him down. We can read on. Why do we quiet him on? Because he said that the reason for this mitzvah is because of the rachamei HaKadosh Baruch Hu ala Of, the mercy of God on birds. Veinokin, it's not so. V'fisha ilu haya derech rachamim lo haya matir shchita, because was it a way of rachamim, lo haya matir shchita klal, God wouldn't have allowed shchita at all. Elehi mitzvah shimit she'ein latam, rather it's a mitzvah shimit, which is a way of saying that it's a chok, it's a gzera, she'ein latam. So notice the Rambam actually is a little bit problematic. Let's just think of all the different things we learned from this Rambam. First of all, we learned that the words Al-Kan Sipur Yagiru Rachamecha, we learned that they are a vakasha. He says, just like you have rachamim on the Kan Sipur, kach hu salenu, so have pity upon us. So it's a vakasha. If it's a vakasha, it has to be in the Shemon Asrei, in the part that's about vakasha, not about shevach, not about hodah, but the middle brachot that are about vakasha. And like we went over in this Charuta, Steve pointed out that the word chus appears in one of the brachot of Vakasha. Do you know which one?
Chus v'rachem aleinu.
Where is that?
V'kama v'rachem u'tzenet v'rachem.
Right. Bruch atah Hashem. Shomea tefillah. It's in Shomea tefillah. So according to the Rambam, we don't add this set of words to Shomea Tefillah. But that's where it would be.
Shomea Tefillah should be there.
Right. Were it to be added to Shomea Tefillah, that's the way it would be added. And then the Rambam gives the reason why we don't add it, what's wrong with it. And he says, he actually combines 2 different things. What I call 3 different possible reasons. 1, 2, and 3. Number 1 was you shouldn't give Tamim. And number 2 was, this time is wrong. And number 3 was, Amiram, this time is too limited. The Ram actually combines 2 and 3. He combines 2 and 3. I'm sorry, he combines 1 and 2. He combines 1 and 2. He says, you shouldn't give Tamim at all. It's just a mitzvah shimit. But then he says that this particular time is wrong. So I guess the Rambam's saying that this particular time is wrong. It's way It's an example of the fact that you always can get in trouble by giving tamim because you might be wrong, and therefore don't give tamim at all. But the Rambam's main point is don't give tamim at all. Which, by the way, we'll see in another 20 minutes is very strange because the Rambam says exactly the opposite in the Guide to the Perplexed.
I don't think he's saying don't give...
He says, Elehi mitzvah shimit. Rather, it's a...
Ve'in la tam. Not... In this particular case, there is one. Which would fit his guide.
You know what? Okay. You know what? Let me think of that. Lefishe, ilu haya derech rachamim lo haya matir shchita. Elehi mitzvah shimit she'in la tam. You know what? You're right. I take it back. And since we just mentioned it, therefore, it's not what I called number one. It's rather number two. It's just you gave the wrong tam. You gave the wrong tam.
Well, and in this case, there is none.
Yeah. There couldn't be a tam, right, for this particular mitzvah saying. No, you're right about that. But the Rambam's approach in general is that it's good to give tamim. You know what? So we can wait. We'll wait to see that in the Rambam. Okay. So now we're going to Rashi, who doesn't agree with the Rambam.
Yeah.
The Rambam said that this is a vakasha. Rashi says, not so. Rashi says, Ve'omrim rachum v'chanunata. God, you are chanun v'rachum. You're merciful and gracious. Valkan Sipur Yagiu Rachamecha. And on the Kan Sipur your Rachamim comes. Shamata Lishalea Khatim, as you said, to send away the mother. Then Rashi goes on to the other additions to the prayer. So Rashi doesn't make it into a Vakasha, but a statement. If it's a statement, it's not in any of the Vakashot of the Shmona Asri. It must be in Hoda, when I just thank God for what he's done. I thank God for the fact that he's Chanun V'Rachum. That's all. So according to Rashi, apparently we put it in Modim. Yeah. Okay, let's go back to the question sheet in which I asked number 8, what could be wrong or problematic with the statement that Al Tov Yizachar Shemecha? So that, I think, is pretty clear, right? That we're thanking God for the Tov and not for the Ra.
Just for the good.
And that brings us to the last Mishnah, Masechet Brachot, which is photostated here on the page. We'll read the Mishnah, because our Mishnah and this Mishnah are connected. So the last Mishnah, Masechet Brachot, says, Chayav Adam Levarech Al Ra'ah, Kishem Shum Levarech Al Hatova. That's, by the way, a very, very hard thing to do. In some situations, it's one of the hardest things that a person could do in his whole life. Shneamar v'haftat Hashem Elokecha v'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol modecha v'chol levavcha b'shnei tzarecha b'yitzra tov v'yitzra v'chol nafshecha filu hu notelet nafshecha v'chol modecha v'chol mamoncha. Devar Acher, and this whole drasha is brought only for the Devar Acher. I want everyone to notice that the drasha is brought as a proof of the first statement of the Mishnah, that one is obligated to bless for the bad as well as the good, and the proof we didn't even read yet. We're about to get to it when you read the Devar Acher. The whole drasha is brought just for what we didn't read yet. And what's brought until now was just brought because it's part of the same literary unit. But what are we looking for? What's the point? The point is the Devar Acher, b'chol modecha, b'chol midah u'midah shehu moded lach. In other words, when the verse says, you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your ma'od, we're interpreting the word ma'od to mean with all the midot that God dishes out to you. Under all the circumstances, all the ways of behaving towards you, that God behaves towards you, in all of them, you should modelo bim'od ma'od. You should thank him, ma'od ma'od, and hear. The drasha is playing on words. It's taking the word ma'od to mean two things at once. It both means midah, and it means modeh. Yeah. It means that you should love God with all your thankfulness, ma'od, for all the midot that he dishes out to you. So it's a play on words, a double play on words.
Everything he measures out to you, you should thank for.
Right. So that's the foundation of the law, that you should thank even for the ra'ah. And in our Mishnah, there's someone who doesn't accept that. And of course, it's very easy to understand why one wouldn't accept it. I have a hard time accepting it myself. What do you mean? Thank God for death and destruction and disease. It's a whole big sugya we'll have to get to when we read this Mishnah here at the end of the second. It's not an easy thing.
Thank you for the tsunami.
Yeah, it's not clear at all. But in any case, Chazal feel that it's an essential pillar. You have to thank God for the good and the bad. And if you don't, if you thank God only for the good, then we mishakim oto. I'll just add that there is a slightly easier way to look at it, at least for me personally. It could be that it's not just a matter of we criticize you for not thanking God for the bad. It's deeper than that. Rather, if you don't thank God for the bad, but only for the good, we suspect you believe that there's another reshut that does the bad. Like a good God and a bad God. Which some point out was Plato's original thesis, and that's the thesis of Zoroastrianism, which some claim is in the background here. So if it's that, it's not just that you're a heretic if you don't thank God for the bad, it's that you're a heretic because we suspect that you believe in a bad God who does the bad, whereas the good God only does the good, then I can more easily understand it.
Well, Rashi, Steve pointed out that there's also a Christian thought that there's, you know, devil doing all these bad things.
It's the same thing. Same thing.
We had another question. What religion was common in the around Babylon at the time these were?
So we're not in Babylonia, right?
We are
in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. We're probably in Eretz Yisrael. Right. The Mishnah certainly formulated there. It could be the idea was floating on Bati Midrash 400 years earlier someplace else, but it's hard to know.
Right.
But we have to assume Eretz Yisrael, and we do have early Christianity,
right.
But on the one hand, Christian theology was hardly developed to what you're pointing at, but on the other hand, we might have Greek,
mm-hmm.
you know, Greek influences
of
gods. And again, Plato's demigod.
Oh.
The bad god.
Uh-huh.
I can't even spell the word.
I don't even know the word.
Yeah, I can't even spell it. Okay. So I'm just going to make a note of that. Okay. And then we go on. So then we get to number 10. In which blessing do you think that one would say modim, modim, and that's clear, it's in modim, right? That's pretty simple. And number 11, what's the problematics of modim, modim, that everyone knows already, shtei rishuyot. So then we get to common denominators. What common denominator unites the second two of these three problematic statements? And here, so it might be the matter of shtei rishuyot, right? If we say that when you thank God for the good, not for the bad, it's indicative of a deeper problem that you believe there's a second God, a bad God. So that's the common denominator with modim modim, that there are two rishuyot.
Mm-hmm.
Could be. Let me see if my notes, if I had any other ideas there for the common denominator. It also be, of course, that they're both of them in modim. If we say that Al-Tob Yizacher Shemech is in modim, and that seems to be where it's put. So that's another common denominator. If we're asking for a common denominator of all three of them, well, of course, we said that Al Kan Sibui Gira Chamech, it's a machloket between Rashi and the Rambam, where you put it. But it might be in Modim, according to Rashi. And therefore, all three of these are in Modim. You really understand a common denominator there. There's one other thing I wanted to say there. I just read last night something that I hadn't learned before in this Mishnah, which I thought was interesting. And this is the name of Professor Ephraim Elimelech Orbach, who wrote a book called Chazal Emunot V'Dayot about 30 years ago, he says that all things being equal, I would expect these three theological deviancies to be ordered in the order that they would be placed into the Shemona Asrei. And therefore, if I look at them, he says, well, it's clear without any question where the third of them is in the Shemona Asrei. Modim, Modim is the beginning of Modim. And therefore, the other two can't be in Modim, because in Modim, they would come after Modim, Modim, and they would be written at the end of the Mishnah, he says. So therefore, they must be in Shema Kolenu, he says. Mm-hmm. Which means he would go like the Rambam. Mm-hmm. An interesting thought. I'm not exactly sure. Al Tob Yizacher Shemecha, we put that into Shema Kolenu. It would have to be something like, God, we remember your name for the good, do more good. Just like Chag Sipur's, God, you did this rachamim for the bird's nest, do more. That would be in Shema Kolenu. Whereas Modim, 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 is at the beginning of Modim.
Yeah, okay. It seems a little bit forced. It makes sense, but...
Yeah. Okay, that's his approach, and it has some basis. Has some basis. Okay. Let's see. Let's talk about the question of severity, how we view the severity here. That was question 14. So number three, Modim Modim, is clearly saying there are two forces. Right? That would seem to be the worst. Al Tob Yizacher Shemecha might be hinting to two forces, but it's not clear that it is. And Al Kan Tzipor Yagiyu Rachamecha is certainly not as bad as anything approaching the heresy of two Rishuyot. So I would think that the order of severity is in ascending order. The least severe is the first, Al Kan Tzipor Yagiyu Rachamecha, and the next is Al Tob Yizacher Shemecha, and the worst is Modim Modim. That's the way it looks. Okay, so next I wanted to point out in question 15 is the big picture. If we have a situation which a shliach tzibur can get up there and say these things and be quieted because of the content of what he said, the content is theologically problematic, that is indicative that he could have got up there and said other things, as long as they're not theologically problematic, we would not mishakim oto. In other words, we're clearly talking about a historical period in which a shliach tzibur has a rather free hand to say what he wants. And that's in accord with things we learned in the past, that at this period, the shliach tzibur had to be a poet who had 18 or 19 themes that he had to cover, and it might even be that the chatimot were fixed, but the content of the bracha had a certain degree of fluidity. And being that it had fluidity, you have the Hadashliach Sibur, who was poetic and quick on his feet and knew how to think and create these things. And you also had to be in your guard, lest he said something that was inappropriate. But if he didn't say something inappropriate, you let him go, even if he said something you never heard before, as long as it fit in the theme. And we have the situation, therefore, that the Kahal is standing with their feet together. There's no silent prayer, and he is saying the prayer for us. We don't have Siddurim, there is no fixed Nusach. He's saying the prayer for us. That appears to be the case.
So, I'm sorry, I know you talked about this before, but so the idea is that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, which would be several hundred years before the Mishnah, set 18 themes, and then the exact text that we have of the Shemona Asrei came when? So it's after the Mishnah.
So it's that the answer to your question is not 100% clear.
Okay.
There are very few statements in the Gemara on the subject. We once did this a few months ago.
Right.
That there's a statement in Gemara that says Anshei Knesset Gedolah Sidru Tfilot Ubrachot. And then there's another statement that says Shimon HaPakuli Sider lifnei Rabban Gamliel beYavne shmones rei brachot. That someone named Shimon Pakuli Sider, he ordered the 18 brachot in the presence of Rabban Gamliel. So, does that mean the Anshei Knesset didn't do it, or he did a second level of it? Mm-hmm. It's not clear. It's not clear if it's a machloket, students from approaches, or it's historical development. But even the time of Yavne, right, is before the Mishnah. Yavne is about the year 100 of the Common Era.
It's 100 years.
80 to 100. Someone sidere it. Mm-hmm. But here, a few years later, it's still not completely misudar.
Could it be that it was the text that we have now, but there you were be permitted to make it more, to add?
Well, it's hard to say. It's almost impossible to say there was some type of fixed text, because we saw that until today, there's still different texts. The Yemenites have one text, the Ashkenazim have one text.
Right, okay.
There are certain differences. Okay. And you go back to the Sidurim of 1,000 years ago from the Geniza fragments, you see the differences were even greater. Mm-hmm. Right? So there was a lot of fluidity that was never, in the time of Talmud, completely pinned down.
Well, let me ask you, you gave us a sheet last week from the Sidur of the Rambam, right? He wrote down his Sidur. He said, does that correspond largely to what we have?
It corresponds largely to the Sfardi,
okay,
today.
So right, somewhere between 200 and 1100, there was, I guess, pretty
well,
wide.
There was a gradual process.
Uh-huh.
And again, even we could look, you can compare the Rambams with the Sfardi Siddur of today. There are differences.
There are differences from before the Rambam, right?
Yes. The Siddur of Rav Amram Gaon, and the Siddur of Rav Hai Gaon, the Siddur of Rav Sadia Gaon. And there's also, like I say, there's Kitei Geniza. There's, how do you say Kitei? There's pages from the Geniza, fragments that have been discovered. And historians have pointed out that the Tefillah was always developing and was always fluid. And one of the major forces that brought about the final stability was the printing press. Mm-hmm.
There's one blessing, an extra one. There's 19 blessings.
Right. Yeah, there's 19
instead of 18. Mm-hmm. Usually it started with 18. Mm-hmm. And then they added one more blessing.
Right. 100%. Yeah. So not everything is clear, but what is clear is that there was a great deal of fluidity until the printing press.
And so the contribution of the Anshei Knesset is not entirely clear.
It's not entirely clear. If we accept the statement that I stated 5 minutes ago, I think it's tikein brachot v'tfilot.
Okay.
It might only mean that they decided you should daven three times a day, but what was the content? This subject is indeed given to machloket historians, basically since the late 19th century. Historians have been arguing over these things, trying to take the different Gemarot and make sense of them, trying to fit in with Kitei Geniza, with comparing different Nuscha'ot of Tfilot that we even have today. Yeah. Okay. But again, our Mishnah plays a role in this historical argument, because you see that there was a degree of fluidity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So, let's not go into the matter of Kriyat Shema, because time is going to be short. Time is already short. So let's continue on with the Mishnah. The second part of the Mishnah is someone who is over lefnei teva v'ta'a. This is apparently a case of someone who gets flustered. Right? He has to be a poet. He's thinking on his feet and suddenly just loses his muse, right? His concentration, and he can't go on because you can't give him a text to read from this no text. He has to feel confident to create what he's creating, and he can't, so you have to yavor acher tachtav, which means yavor lifnei teva. Right? The expression yavor also means pass in front of the box. Velo yesarvan botasha, he shouldn't be a refusnik. Why? Because of tircha de tzibora. Right, if one shliach tzibur suddenly has to stop another to go in his place, you have to get him in there quickly so that you don't have a hefsek in the tefillah, and also you don't have tircha de tzibur. Everyone is waiting. And minayin u'matchil, mitchilat ha-bracha sheta'aba, at the beginning of the bracha that he made a mistake, and he doesn't have to go back to the beginning. Because this is a tefillah, not of the individual, it's of the kahal. And as long as you have the same kahal, you can have a different person saying it. It's not like it was the tefillah of the individual, only he can say it. It was of the kahal, and the kahal is still there. They could use now a different shliach tzibur to pinch hit for the first guy. Okay, so we saw already Rashi, we saw the Rambam, we saw the Mishnah. Let's end with the Gemara. Okay. Yeah, we did everything. We did just about everything on page one. So this Gemara, again, is the nexus of the Machloket of Tamei HaMitzvot. And it goes like this. It's the Gemara on our Mishnah. Bishlama modim modim meshakim oto. It's okay, it's in peace, it makes sense. Right? The matter of modim modim meshakim oto. Why? Mishum de mechazek eshtei rishuyot. It appears as if there's two rishuyot. Val tov yizachar shamecha nami. Nami means what?
Also.
It's also bishlam, it also makes sense.
Yeah.
Why does it make sense? Because mashmala tova v'lora, that he's saying it on the ra, not on the tova.
Thank God for the tova.
Right. And it's contradicting the Mishnah. The Tanaz, we learned in the Mishnah, chayav adam levrech ala ra, kishem shem levrech ala tova. Ela, rather, we have a problem with al kansi po yigiyu rachamecha. My time, what's the reason for that? What's so problematic? And the answer is, pligi ba trei amurei b'marava. Argued in it, to Amoraim in the West. And we don't know what the problem is. There's a machloket what the problem is. Rabbi Yossi bar Avin, Rabbi Yossi bar Zavida, they had an argument. Chadam, one of them said, Mipnei shematil kina b'maaseh breshit, because he cast jealousy into the works of creation. Yeah. In other words, I won't say in other words, I'll take it back. I'll go on first. The Chadaman 1 says, Mipnei shosemi dotav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu rachamim v'inam elek zerot, because he makes the characteristics of a Kodesh Baruch Hu into Rachamim, whereas they're nothing but Gzeirot. So the second reason given here for the problematics of this matter of Kan Sipur, the second reason is clear. The second reason holds that, as we've talked earlier, you're not allowed, it's the wrong thing, it's improper to claim that you understand God's Torah. And there's a whole approach, a whole theological approach that has so many different ramifications. You're not allowed to understand too much. It's just for the doing, the accepting, the obedience, the submission, the retreat in the face of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Actually, to be very radical about it, according to this approach, all of Judaism is on the basis of the paradigm of the Akedah. Akedat Yitzchak. Everything is about sacrificing for a Kodesh Baruch Hu. It's not about partnership, not about love, not about understanding. It's all about accepting Zerotav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Of course, I'm being a little bit radical now, but I'm taking the approach and giving it its fullest expression in Jewish thought. All of Judaism is one big akedah. It's all retreat in the face of the inscrutable will of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And Chas V'Shalom, that you think you could give reasons. Who are you? It's heretical because it's making yourself into a Kodesh Baruch Hu. You think you're going to understand his reasons? It's quite beyond you. It's impossible. But even though that approach has a certain allure, and it does make sense, but it's not the only approach. As we see, there's a machloket here, and the machloket, the other approach, the first approach, does not agree. Now, the first approach seems to clearly believe you can give reasons. The fact that the reason was given of Rachamim is not the reason why this is theologically problematic. This is another reason, which means they have a machloket. One says all of Judaism is the Akedah. Another says no. There's an aspect of Judaism of giving reasons, of understanding, of love, of partnership, of connection, of understanding, of nearness, of love, of chesed. So then, if that's the case, so what is the theological problem with saying Al-Kan Sipur Yabgiu Rachamecha? So the reason is Mitil Kina, which is basically what Amiram said earlier, half an hour ago, what I called reason number, did I call it one or three? I don't remember.
I
called it three?
One, yeah.
Right.
Guessing
it one. Right. Reason number three, that you limited God's Rachamim. You cast jealousy as if to say that God has mercy on the birds but not on the bears. Or not on human beings, or not on someone. Whereas the truth is Rachamav HaKol Na'asav. God has mercy on all creatures.
Yeah.
So it's really what we call a machloket kotvit. It's a rather a polar machloket. One says you attributed too little mercy. The other says you can't attribute mercy at all. You can't attribute reasons at all. So it's on the basis of the first reason given here that there's no theological objection to giving tamei mitzvot. It's on the basis of that that Jewish thought goes on and gives reasons. And the way I want to... Can we just see the Rambam before we go? Is that okay? So I just want to... Let's end with the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim, which is on the last page. We won't get to see other midrashim I brought. We can't see everything, but it's instructive to see the Rambam. The Moreh Nevuchim was written in Arabic. Here's a Hebrew translation, and here's an English translation. We'll read the English.
Where is it?
It's in the bracket. We'll read the English on the left-hand side. It is likewise forbidden to slaughter it and its young on the same day. There's a mitzvah. You can't slaughter an animal and its young on the same day. This being a precautionary measure in order to avoid slaughtering the young animal in front of its mother. For in these cases, animals feel very great pain, there being no difference between this pain between man and the other animals. For the love and the tenderness of a mother for her child is not consequent upon reason, but upon the activity of the imaginative faculty, which is found in most animals just as it is in man. This law applies in particularly to ox and lamb, can slaughter the mother and its young in the same day, because these are the domestic animals that we are allowed to eat, and that in most cases the usual to eat. In their case, the mother can be differentiated from their young. This is also the reason for the commandment to let the mother go, bird go from the nest. For in general, the eggs over which the bird has sat and the young that need their mother are not fit to be eaten. If then the mother is let go and escapes of her own accord, she will not be pained by seeing that the young are taken away. In most cases, this will lead to people leaving everything alone. For what may be taken is in most cases not fitten to be eaten. So the reason is to stop you at all from interfering with the mother and the nest, so you won't take anything. And that's because of the pain of the mother, pain of the birds. If the law takes into consideration these pains of the soul in the case of beasts and birds, what will be the case with regard to the individuals of the human species as a whole? And now listen to this. You must not allege as an objection against me the dictum of the sages, may their memory be blessed, quote, and it's a quote from our Mishnah, he who says, thy mercy extends to young birds, and so on. For this is one of the two opinions mentioned by us, and it's mentioned in the Gemara. I mean the opinion of those who think that there is no reason for the law except only the will of God, but as for us, we follow in the second opinion. In other words, says the Rambam, this opinion of the Gemara, that you can't say, may God's mercy extend to the mother's nest. The reason you can't say it is because you're not allowed to give reasons for the law. But there's another reason there in the Gemara. And it's not that you're not allowed to give reasons, it's because this particular reason arouses jealousy, which means you're allowed to give reasons, and we, says the Rambam, hold like that other opinion. So the Rambam is so clear in saying, I know there are those who say you can't give tamim, but we hold differently. Okay.